Hello?
Five 19 on Downtown. 40 years ago this month, one of the best and most influential television series in the history of the medium went off the air after a lengthy run of 142 episodes, talking, of course, about the Bob Newhart Show. Our next guest has written a wonderful oral history of the series on The Hollywood Reporter. We're pleased to be joined by Mark Freeman this afternoon. Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. I loved your piece. It was great to hear those memories of not only the people who were involved in the creation of the show, but a whole lot of folks who were influenced by what Bob Newhart and Dave Davis and Lorenzo Music and the rest of the creators did.
Yeah, I kind of, when I was putting it together, I've done several of these oral histories, and one of the things I was thinking about based on my age was that I had a feeling the comedians in that 40 to 50-year-old range would have watched it in childhood, either in first run or syndication, and based on the level of their comedy and the type of comedy, it would have impacted them. So I chose selectively, but I think ultimately accurately.
For somebody who was so laid back and well buttoned down in Bob Newhart, this really was in many ways a revolutionary TV series. What made this show unique, Mark?
Well, there's a couple aspects. One is Bob's humor, which everyone describes as, which I think is a good description, actually, as a reactive humor. So there was subtlety to the humor. It wasn't set up punchline. Michael Zimberg, who worked on the show in many different capacities, had a very good summation, which was that a character would say something funny, Bob would respond to it without any language, it was all facial expressions or maybe a stammer, which was funny, and then he would deliver a line, which was funny. So you had this three-level punch for one simple setup or even one joke. But the humor itself was just very subtle. The show is kind of a precursor to reality comedy. You could even, a lot of people make the jump to Seinfeld of being a show about nothing. Dave Davis made a big point of pointing out that he really established a show in a foundation of real situations. He didn't want crazy burlesque or slapstick pie in the face and so on. He wanted situations that anyone could relate to, so they don't have to relate to being a psychologist. They relate to the situations of family, work, friends, and so on.
You learned in your conversations that Bob Newhart was a little reluctant to do the show at first. He did know Lorenzo Music, I think, from the Smothers Brothers series, so that helped grease the skids a little bit.
Yeah, I didn't go into the full detail of it, but Lorenzo Music and Carl Gottlieb were working on the Smothers Brothers. Bob was appearing as a guest, and they wrote a piece for him called, I believe, The Air Traffic Controller, which Bob then put into his act and used it for years afterwards, still probably using it today. And he said that typically people were sending him things all the time, and that out of 1,000 pieces, maybe 10 were interesting. So it was surprising to him that the quality of this really captured his voice. So from there, he did other specials, and I believe there was a comedy television movie, and he used Lorenzo for that. So he had that whole connection with Lorenzo, and then Lorenzo partnered with Dave Davis for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and Dave was a huge fan of Bob, and they kept trying to get him. They wrote for Love American Style an episode, and he wasn't able to do that. They wrote an episode of Mary Tyler Moore for him, and he wasn't able to do that. So MTM eventually wanted to expand away from just the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and they went to those guys and basically said, hey, do you got any ideas? And of course, Bob. Got to be Bob.
So. We're talking with Mark Freeman of The Hollywood Reporter. One of the most important decisions they made, and it's one that Bob Newhart certainly endorsed, was to make the Hartleys a couple without children.
Yeah, and if you think about it, there's two things, and one's kind of a non sequitur, but if you think about the show from 72 to 78, families, there were always families, and it was always going to be about what Bob said he didn't want, which is Dad's an imbecile and the family has to rally around and solve things, and then they all laugh around Dad's chair at the end. They wanted a show without kids, which at the time is pretty revolutionary, similar to, in talking to different people from the show, we could not think of a show beforehand in which a TV series was based specifically on a comedian's comedy, their stand-up act. That really was the first one to do that. And obviously Bob in his act doesn't talk about my life with kids or so on. And he has a family and he loves talking about his grandkids and his kids, but that wasn't his act. So it wouldn't fit in there, and it would have changed the dynamic of him and his comedy.
And that made the choice of his occupation, which, as I learned in your piece, they went through several different possibilities, but the idea of being a psychologist was great because it was so similar to the listening and then reacting that Bob Newhart did in that stand-up act.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things when they were coming up with ideas was, and most people you talk to, they get confused, psychiatrist, psychologist, and some couldn't even remember which one he was. But Bob, I believe it was, had told me they didn't want to do psychiatrist because that deals with more serious issues and patients, and they didn't want to belittle that practice at all that people need. And so they thought psychologist would fit more into the dynamic of, as you said, somebody who listens and reacts. And if you watch any episode, you will see him do that up and down no matter where he is.
Well, they struck gold when they found Suzanne Plachette to play his wife, and that all comes, as I learned from your piece, from Lorenzo Music seeing her on The Tonight Show.
Yeah, that's kind of a funny story in that you think all the thought process that goes into casting somebody. They were having problems casting her. They needed someone to play off of Bob, and they needed someone who was a strong character, a strong female character who would be working and Bob's equal, and in a lot of ways Bob's superior in certain aspects. And I know they were tossing around names. The one that I had heard about was Lois Nettleton, but it just by happenstance she was on Johnny Carson, and what Lorenzo liked about her so much was she kept her own. She held her own and bantered with him, had a great sense of humor, great improvisational thought process, and just came alive on the show to the point that Lorenzo mentioned her. And the only question was, she was a film actress, would she want to do a show like that? And it just happened to be, even though you never saw it on the show, she was pregnant at the time. And because she was pregnant, she kind of wanted to settle down in one situation. And so it was kind of the perfect timing or melding of worlds.
One of the key players in the series who was so great was next-door neighbor Howard Borden, a veteran comedic actor, Bill Daly, who had been on I Dream of Jeannie. He was so great on the show, but I love the stories that people told about him in your oral history, that not everybody knew where Bill Daly might be coming from and what lines he might say at any given time.
Well, the best comparison, in a way, would be Michael Richards as Kramer, but they're very different in that when Dave and Lorenzo created the series, they said there always had to be a reason for Howard to come into the room. He wouldn't just barge in. He would come in usually to ask them to water his plants because he was a navigator and he was going out of town, whereas Kramer typically just barged in and was probably even more physical. Well, not probably. He was more physical than Howard Borden. But the thing about Howard was Bill Daly comes from a jazz background, improvisational music, and he at times wouldn't remember his lines, but he'd remember a line, and if he couldn't, he would come up with something. And if you know the show at all, Jay Tarsis, one of the writers, talked about the fact that he would move his fingers, usually against his chest, if he couldn't remember a line. That was him kind of doing his computer process of trying to recall it. And I had never thought of that before. I just thought it was a tic or something with the character. But I can actually picture that when he says that, of many times where he would put his hand against his chest and be, you know, twiddling with his fingers, which apparently was some kind of trigger for him.
The people in the office were so great. Peter Bonners, who went on to a very successful career as a director as well, Marsha Wallace, and then the group of patients from, the best, obviously, Jack Riley as Elliot Carlin, but people like John Fiedler, so many terrific character actors who passed through Dr. Hartley's office.
Yeah, and if I had had more room, as in a longer article or unlimited article, I would have touched more on them. And because it was the first group, which is four or five people, which the writers enjoyed so much that they created the second group so they could have more characters, all with problems. And the way that they interacted with each other and interacted with Bob, they couldn't go on enough, the people, mostly in the crew and the performers who I spoke with, about how great they all were, Mr. Peterson and such, and I could go with different actors, but they're all wonderful actors. One of the things which I also didn't mention, which is interesting, is Howard Hessman played a character in the second group, and he came out as gay to Bob, and that was the first character on TV to do that, and it was handled in a classy way. You had Bob's reaction to it, but as people said, his reaction to it often mirrored how the audience would react to it. So the character's declaration at the time, which is 74, 75, was not awkward in any way. It was actually very natural, and the way they handled it, the humor of it, was really just Bob's reaction to it. He wasn't fazed by it, but it was just a very good way to introduce a new topic to television, a real topic.
We played the opening theme of the series, a terrific theme. Lorenzo Music and his wife wrote it and really told you a lot about the character of Bob Hartley as the show opened.
Yeah, at its core, the opening is just Bob going home. And having said that, Dave was really proud because he directed the shoot. It was like a two-day shoot, and he was really proud of coming up with all these subtleties of Bob in a newspaper, taking out a newspaper on a subway train, or waiting at a platform to get onto the subway. There was a scene that they ultimately didn't use that Dave had asked about. He wanted to shoot something on the windiest corner in the city, because Chicago's the windy city, and they found this corner, and the idea was Bob would round the corner and his hat would blow off, an MTM kind of thing. Mary tosses her hat, that one would blow. And so they go there that day, and there's no wind. And they had to get a wind machine to try to recreate the wind, and for all that effort, they didn't even use it in the opening. If you watch it, it's not even there. So,
you highlight a couple of terrific episodes. What was Bob Newhart's favorite episode of the series?
I don't think he had one in particular. There are moments which he touches on. Some of them are the ones that Conan O'Brien's a good friend of his, and Conan mentioned some that are just meaningful lines to him. He really does like the elevator one where Bob, the elevator opens and there's no elevator there, and Bob ends up jumping on the cable, elevator cable, and nobody notices because they're still talking. And then that leads to his fear of elevators and such. A lot of people remember, and it was interesting because I was talking to my sister about this, it's called the Mugu Gaipan episode.
Yes.
And it's weird. If you Google Mugu Gaipan Bob Newhart, it pops up. And I thought, oh, nobody will remember that episode. But it all revolves around their being drunk. Emily goes to Seattle for Thanksgiving. And there's four or five of them, Mr. Carlin, Howard, Jerry and Bob, and they're at Bob's house, and they get drunk, and they order Chinese food. And it doesn't sound like a lot would go on, but he orders the food, and instead of saying Dr. Bob Hartley, he orders it as Dr. Bob Hartley. And then with the Mugu Gaipan, he orders it, and then Howard says, can you get me some Mugu Gaipan? So he orders that into the phone, and he's drunk. And then Jerry says, I want it too. And so Bob says, more Mugu Gugu. And then Howard says, oh, you're talking, that's baby Chinese food talk. So it's just like these silly throwaway jokes, but it works really well because they're not making fun of being drunk. It's just they are drunk.
We were just talking about that episode the other day. It was great. Now, also, you mentioned your sister, Joanne Freeman, who's a good friend of the show. And she was telling me you have since heard from Bob Newhart, who was very pleased with how this oral history came out.
Yeah, that was a pleasant surprise. Everyone said how wonderful Bob was before I spoke to him. Just a regular guy, very friendly, and he couldn't have been nicer. We spoke. He had there was one little thing he said, "Oh, I'm going to have to check with my wife about one little fact that he brought up." He called me back for that, which was a surprise. And then the article went live on Thursday, and I was working, and sure enough, on my ID on my phone says Bob Newhart, which kind of was like, uh-oh, it could go one of two ways. But no, Bob was very happy. It's the only piece that marries the voices of a lot of people from the show. You can find interviews where they put them together, some talking heads, but there's nothing really in print to talk to cast and crew together about their recollections. And I enjoy writing those things. In a sense, I have to stand off. I stand back. I take in the information. I compile it. I put it together. But I stand back and let the voices speak for themselves, which I think adds just a lot of value to the storytelling.
Yeah, some of the voices that you had in the article of the people you talked to, it just covered such a wide breadth of entertainment, from filmmakers to stand-up comedians to sitcom actors. I mean, his influence just covered the whole spectrum of comedy.
Yeah, and very different conversations I had with the different comedians and celebrities about it, from some having very personal memories of watching it as kids. Stephen Wright and I got into a long conversation about comedic timing, which Stephen Wright has as a very specific characteristic of his work. And he had never really put it together with Bob's, but he thought about it, and he was like, you know, every 20 years or so, somebody comes along and they mess with the timing and the rhythm of comedy and their humor. And so we got into this whole conversation about that. And a lot of people in general took the rhythm and timing, and if you think about the performance of a man on stage with a phone where you don't hear the other end of the conversation, that's bringing a lot more than what people were used to seeing in comedy, stand-up punchlines, Henny Youngman kind of humor, or Jerry Lewis kind of slapstick. It was intelligent humor where, and Bob was telling me this actually when he called me, it was intelligent humor where the audience really had to be intelligent enough to figure out what was being said on the other side, because Bob obviously responded to that, but you didn't know what he said yet. You did because of what his answer was. So there was some give and take with the audience that they kind of had to participate in the comedy, which is also very different for the time, even for now, really.
Yeah, intelligent and also timeless. I, after reading the article and watching some of the clips, I called in a coworker today and said, had her watch the elevator one that you had already mentioned. The ending where it opens up on the Grim Reaper, there's room for one more, and just Newhart's reaction and timing to that. You know, someone that was born well after this show went off the air, and she just found it hilarious because it doesn't matter when you see it, it's funny.
Yeah, if you remove... Henry Winkler had some comment about how he hated his lapels for the episode he was on. But, you know, if you remove the clothing aspect of it, that is something that was intentional. Bob made a point of saying, we're not going to reference Gerald Ford. We're not going to reference, say, the Vietnam War. We're not going to reference current events of the time to make it timeless. And in that sense, Seinfeld does that too. They have episodes where they might mention like the Schindler's List episode or so on, but a lot of it is just about human behavior. And in that sense, that's always going to be timeless. And the fact that, again, it was based in reality like Dave and Lorenzo wanted, that makes it timeless.
Mark, we could do a whole hour with you, because I also wanted to mention that, and I've told you this in an email, how much I enjoyed your oral history of MASH that you did a couple of months ago, where you gathered surviving members of the cast and crew, and gosh, that was just absolutely delightful as well.
Well, thank you for that. You know, there's two quick things I want to mention about that. One is that article ended up being really popular, which just shows you how many MASH fans there still are out there. And in a sense, similar to Newhart, you have that element where you can get people recall the show, but what's sweet about it is they recall watching it with their parents. And it's this nice family memory they have of generations mixing, getting the same, maybe different aspects of humor out of something, but watching something together and sharing an experience, which I think is really awesome. At the same time, the other thing I was going to mention was, because I will never come across this again, the MASH cast and crew are so close to each other. And the theme of that particular oral history was family, and I couldn't even there's no way to overstate that, how much of a family they are. They still email each other. They have groups together. They get together in different packets. It's just amazing, because if you think, remove the Hollywood aspect of it, if you work with people 40 years ago, what are the chances are that entire group will more or less stay together and in touch and close? That just says a lot about the work environment of what they created.
Well, it's all available at HollywoodReporter.com, the newest one, this terrific oral history of the Bob Newhart Show. Mark Freeman, just a blast to talk with you. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon. I hope we can do it again down the road.
That sounds great, and thank you for calling me.
Check it out yourself. You're going to love it. Oral history of the Bob Newhart Show and Mark's piece on MASH as well. Again, HollywoodReporter.com.